The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the AARP Bulletin, and also, time allowing, from a Money Magazine. Our programming today is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call them at 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. And now a timely article from the Bulletin in the Your Health section. This is Flu Deaths on the Rise for Older Americans. Fatalities jump sixfold over 2 years. Experts say current vaccines are ineffective at blocking an evolving virus. This is by Thomas Frank. As a new flu season arrives, older Americans are facing an increased risk of dying from the virus. An AARP Bulletin analysis of government data reveals that deaths attributed to the flu among those 65 and older have spiked in recent years. More than 12,000 people ages 65 and older died from the disease during the last flu season, starting October 1, 2017. That is more than double the death toll of the 2016-17 flu season and six times the number from 2015-16, the Bulletin found when analyzing data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. In addition to a large death toll in 2017-18, the number of flu-related hospitalizations of those 65 and older was higher than we've seen in any other previous year, CDC spokeswoman Kristen Nordland says. While the rate of flu fatalities has increased across all age groups, the failure to effectively battle the virus is having an outsized impact on older Americans. Nearly 80% of those who died from flu last season were 65 or older. The flu accounts for about 5% of all winter deaths among older Americans, says Michael Jackson, a vaccine and infectious disease researcher for Kaiser Permanente. These trends seem to negate what should be a success story. People aged 65 and older are much better than others at getting annual flu shots. In 2017, 69% of seniors got a flu shot, while the vaccination rate was 46% for people ages 50 to 64, 33% for ages 18 to 49, and 48% for those 17 and younger. There is no requirement that adult flu deaths be reported to the CDC, making it difficult to provide a precise fatality count. The CDC makes a preliminary count by studying death certificates and updates the preliminary death count every week on a publicly available database. The Bulletin used the database for its calculations, finding that 12,163 people, 65 and over, had died from the flu by late July. This is a wake-up call for the world, says Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. For many decades, we thought the flu vaccine worked better than it did. People always thought we had the vaccine we need. Better vaccines needed. In late February, amid soaring numbers of flu deaths and pressure from Congress, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, announced a major initiative to develop a new, more effective vaccine. A so-called universal flu vaccine would protect people against all strains of flu instead of just a few, and would be needed only once every few years instead of every year. The announcement came after a four-week stretch that saw the flu kill older Americans at a rate of 169 people a day, or 7 people per hour, the Bulletin found. Weeks before the NIAID announcement, Senator Edward Markey, Democrat, Massachusetts, called federal spending on new vaccines simply not enough and proposed $1 billion over 5 years for research. In March, Congress allocated $100 million for 2018-19 an increase from the $64 million the government spent in 2017-18. We are far, far short of what's necessary to do the basic research to understand how to develop a universal or game-changing flu vaccine, Osterholm says. We need to spend $1 billion a year for at least the next 5 to 7 years. Markey says the $100 million in funding, while short of the $200 million he sought for next year, still supercharges federal efforts to improve flu vaccines. The flu's challenges. The development of effective flu vaccines has been a challenge since the shots were first administered in the 1940s to protect U.S. soldiers, a group that had suffered a huge number of flu deaths during World War I. In its best years, the flu vaccine is 60% effective, meaning people who get a flu shot are 60% less likely to get the disease than people who do not get a shot. In its worst years, the vaccine is only 10% effective. The CDC projected in February that the 2017-18 vaccine was about 36% effective, meaning that people who get the shot were 36% less likely to contract the flu. The CDC has not assessed the 2018-19 vaccine, but a study by Rice University predicts that the flu vaccine will likely have the same reduced efficacy as the vaccines used in the previous 2 years. The shortcomings occur because the flu virus has many forms or strains. Scientists must try to predict the strain that will dominate in an upcoming season for vaccine development. This is different for viruses such as measles, which don't change. Childhood vaccinations protect people for life. The flu virus is constantly changing. It's a moving target, CDC epidemiologist Alicia Budd says. Each year, you're basically creating a brand new product. As they are grown in labs, the viruses used in the vaccines are matched to the expected flu strain. But during growth, their genetic makeup often changes, which can make them less effective, Budd says. There's a lot more work that needs to be done to try to understand exactly what these genetic changes are and what the subsequent implications might be, she says. In people 65 and older, the problem is heightened because their immune systems have become inherently weaker due to age. That makes them even less responsive to vaccines. In 2012-13, the flu vaccine was only 11% effective for seniors, even though it was 49% effective for the overall population, according to a study published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. The vaccine in 2010-11 was 60% effective in the overall population, but only 38% effective for seniors, another CDC-funded report shows. A vaccine for older Americans. For years, researchers vastly overestimated the flu vaccine's effectiveness on people age 65 and older. In assembling study groups, researchers included too many healthy individuals who were generally more resistant to the flu. Scientists discovered the errors in the mid-2000s and began designing more accurate studies. But the overestimations minimized any urgency to improve vaccines for the 65-plus population, says Loni Simonson, an infectious disease expert at George Washington University, who helped debunk the earlier studies. If you thought the vaccine worked so well in the elderly, you wouldn't question that the existing vaccines weren't good enough, Simonson says. Our research led to better formulations for seniors, and those are used now. A high-dose flu vaccine for individuals 65 and older, Fluzone High-Dose, has been shown to be more effective, according to the CDC. But some health clinics have been slow to offer it because it is new and unfamiliar. The Washington State Vaccine Advisory Committee recommended in August 2017 that healthcare providers in the state offer seniors the high-dose vaccine or an adjuvanted vaccine that has an added ingredient to boost the body's immune response. It was the first time the committee had made such a recommendation, says Kathy Lofi, the state health officer in Washington. We had been hearing after the high-dose vaccine came out that a lot of clinics weren't even buying it, Lofi says. Some clinics were just deciding to stick with the standard-dose vaccine. The high-dose vaccine was new, and initially there wasn't a lot of data about it. Lofi says she does not know how many clinics offered the high-dose vaccine in 2017-18 or how many people received it. The CDC urges everyone who is at least 6 months old to get an annual flu shot and says older people and infants are at particular risk for the flu. Although the vaccine may provide only limited protection, health officials say, it is better than nothing. Says Bud, the CDC epidemiologist, while we have an imperfect vaccine, it still ends up preventing a significant amount of illness. This is written by Thomas Frank, who is an investigative journalist, formerly with USA Today. And there's also a little sidebar here about three tips to protect yourself. One, get a flu shot. There are two vaccines designed for people 65 or older, a high-dose vaccine, Fluzone High-Dose, and an adjuvanted flu vaccine, Fluad, that's F-L-U-A-D, with an ingredient that helps boost the body's immune response. Both are considered safe, although for some people they can produce mild headaches, muscle aches, malaise, and redness at the injection site. Two, practice good health habits. Regularly wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are ill. Try not to touch your eyes, nose, and mouth frequently. Get enough sleep. Eat a healthy diet. Drink plenty of fluids. And exercise regularly. And number three, if you're 65 or older, make sure you are up to date with pneumococcal vaccines, which help prevent pneumonia, meningitis, and sepsis. People with the flu are more likely to develop pneumonia. Now, on a different note, also from the AARP Bulletin, here is a Q&A session with Eric Idle, the former Monty Python merry prankster, who is now 75, and he's talking about the bright side of not getting hit by a London bus so far. Life is a gift, but it has diminishing returns, so it's important to laugh. So the interviewer says, in your new book, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, you depict your horrible boarding school. Did you learn about comedy there? I learned that comedy disarms bullies. It's very hard to hit someone when you're laughing. Kids have a very subversive view of the world, and I think that's where comedy lurks. It seeks out those crevices between how we perceive things and how things really are, or could be looked at from a different viewpoint. Comedy is a form of truth-telling. The Emperor's New Clothes is the perfect paradigm. Somebody says, that man has got no clothes on, and everybody laughs. But there are two sides to that. One is that we want that truth at all costs, and the other is that the people who actually provide it are the most screwed up people on the planet. Interviewer, you talk about the amazing renaissance your generation in England created after World War II. Why did that happen? We grew up with food rationing, no television. It was a depressing world. Then, suddenly, in our teenage years, a rebellion happened. A confluence of many things made that possible, like electric guitars and the music coming from America, which we all listened to on our hidden radio sets. That American influence pervaded places like Liverpool, near where he grew up, and connected people who felt isolated and different. Question, what's the secret of Monty Python's success? Nobody had quite gone where we were going. We were moving away from satire, which had been the prevailing genre on British television, into a more generalized silliness, which somehow struck a chord. We were also very anti-authoritarian, and we were always looking for things that hadn't been laughed at yet. I certainly can't explain how it would last 50 years. The 50th anniversary is next year. It's just astounding to me. Question, why is your tongue-in-cheek anthem, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, the most requested song at British funerals? That's irony, isn't it? There's certainly no bright side when it comes to your own funeral. That's why people get a kick out of singing it. That song has been my personal motto when I look back at my life. And it's a pretty good theme for our generation. Do you think irony is dead? No, but this is a time for sarcasm and heavy-handed humor more than gentle irony. on social media, if you use irony, you're in real danger. People don't understand innuendo or double meaning. They take everything at face value. You call yourself the wicket keeper of the Monty Python group. What's that? That's a cricket term. It's like the catcher in baseball. You're not bowling, you're receiving. When I met George Harrison, I found that we played similar roles in our groups, having strong people on either side of us and trying to poke in between the gaps. I think that's why we had such a good friendship. What did you admire most about George? Oh, if you're feeling down or grumpy or cross, you can't go much wrong thinking about what George would say. Hey, don't take yourself so seriously. You're just a speck in the universe. That quick pull back was a very good lesson he taught me. What else did you learn from him? Well, the Beatles were the most famous people in the world. So George learned quickly that fame isn't what it's all about. It's not the goal. You just have to deal with it and move on to what you want to do. What's your strategy? Being nicer to people. When I was younger, fans would approach me and I would say, F off. But that doesn't work for too long. You have to remember when someone comes up to you in the airport, they're remembering something funny you did and they're just saying thank you. You have to be more than gracious because you're awfully lucky to receive it. What's your advice for people over 50? Never start a sentence with the phrase, I remember. The other thing is to be as pleasant as possible. Life is an extraordinary gift, but it has diminishing returns, so it's important to laugh. It's not about you anymore. You don't matter. And that takes the pressure off of having to be successful or earn a lot of money. I ascribe to the London bus philosophy of life. Any minute you may be just about to walk under a London bus. You're at the edge of your life at every moment. And as you get older, it becomes more imperative to appreciate that. 50 is a good time to start. I started a whole new act at 50 by moving to America. Because America is the land of opportunity, you can change. You aren't stuck in your role. So don't waste any time. There's no time to lose. Get on and enjoy the last half of your life, and make sure you do. This interview was by Hugh Delahanty. And now, still in the bulletin, we will shift to money matters. Here's an article called Smart Tax Moves to Make Now. Act quickly to save money and time under new IRS rules. Filing season doesn't arrive until spring, but you'll want to act soon to take advantage of provisions in the sweeping tax law passed in late 2017. Experts say these are the biggest changes affecting taxpayers 50 and older, and the steps you need to take before year's end to get your biggest benefit. A boost for the self-employed. Starting in 2018, many independent contractors and small business owners can get a 20% federal tax deduction on their business income. In other words, they're liable for taxes on only $80 of every $100 they make. The deduction starts phasing out if their total taxable income surpasses $157,500 if single, or doubled that if married and filing jointly. Other math is involved, but the probable upshot is lower taxes if you become or remain a freelancer. For example, a self-employed architect making $40,000 a year would see her taxes cut $672, the Tax Foundation calculates. Do this now. Start the business you always dreamed of. Got a hobby or talent you'd like to monetize? Now's a great time to try. You might also invest more in a business you're already running, or if you'd like a lighter work schedule, switch from employee to freelancer. In terms of taxes, you can work the exact same job and be way better off being an independent contractor, says Stacy Johnson, a CPA and president of Money Talks News. A higher bar for medical deductions. Under the new bill, taxpayers this year can deduct unreimbursed medical expenses that exceed 7.5% of their adjusted gross income. Beginning in 2019, however, that figure rises to 10%. Do this now. See your doctor and get your meds. if your medical expenses are already near 7% or higher, and if there's something you want a doctor to check out, you might go now, says Ann Brownholtz, senior tax advisor for the financial advisory firm The Colony Group. You could also pay now for future medical expenses, such as prescription drugs or medical equipment, says Johnson. Less of a break for state and local taxes. In past years, people could deduct state and local taxes, SALT, SALT, they paid, such as income and property taxes, on their federal return. But now those deductions are limited to $10,000 per return, or $5,000 for married people filing separately, no matter how much tax you pay locally. That could mean a tax bite for some wealthy folks in high-tax areas. For example, the H&R Block Tax Institute estimates that a New Yorker making $500,000 a year would pay $6,300 more under the new law, mostly because of the SALT change. Do this now. Stay calm and maybe consult a professional. Although this news looks bad if you pay a lot of SALT, it probably isn't, says Brownholtz. That's because, for most people, the deductions loss will be offset by other tax code changes, including an easing of the alternative minimum tax. Talk to your accountant if your wealth resembles that of the hypothetical New York executive and delay any panicked plans to move to a low-tax state. A jump in the standard deduction. The biggest change in the tax law is the near doubling of the standard deduction to $12,000 for single filers and to $24,000 for married couples filing jointly. People 65 and older filing singly can deduct another $1,600, while couples filing jointly are allowed a $1,300 deduction for each spouse of that age. For tax year 2016, 30% of filers itemized rather than taking the standard deduction, but the higher standard deduction is expected to result in many fewer itemizers, says H&R Block's Gil Charney. Do this now. Stop collecting all those darn receipts. Take a look at your 2017 return. If your state and local taxes up to $10,000, remember, charitable contributions and medical expenses don't come close to your household standard deduction this year. And if your deductible expenses haven't shot up since last year, don't sweat assembling all the paperwork for those outlays this year. Different rules for alimony. Under current regulations, an ex-spouse paying alimony gets to deduct those payments on his or her return, and the ex receiving it has to declare it as taxable income. But for divorce settlements finalized January 1, 2019 or later, the payer cannot deduct the alimony, while the recipient does not have to claim it as income. This is a big one, Charney says. Do this now. Splitting up, rerun the numbers. If you can't finalize your divorce by New Year's Eve, work with an accountant or certified divorce financial analyst. Yes, that's a real thing, and it's legit, to equalize the impact on both spouses, says Carol Lee Roberts, president of the Institute for Divorce Financial Analysis. Lily Vasilev, author of Money and Divorce, The Essential Roadmap to Mastering Financial Decisions, also suggests considering alternatives to alimony, such as covering certain medical and educational costs for an ex-spouse or child, which may be tax-deductible for the payer. New savings for school. Starting this year, families have more ways to use money in 529 or 529 savings plans, investment accounts that can grow tax-free and from which money can be withdrawn tax-free to pay for education expenses. Instead of using that money only for college or graduate school, parents and grandparents can now spend a total of $10,000 per child each year toward K-12 tuition expenses. One catch, while many states give residents state tax deductions for 529 plan contributions, some states are revoking tax breaks when money is used for these newly allowed expenses. Do this now. Open or add to a 529 plan. Whether or not the child in your family could use the money before college, 529 plans are a great way to save for his or her education. For a list of low-expense plans, search online for NerdWallet 529. If you plan on using the money for secondary school rather than college, check your state's rules, and because you'd need the money earlier than you would for college, invest your 529 more conservatively, suggests Brownholtz, perhaps putting slightly more in bonds and slightly less in stocks. This is by Bruce Horowitz, who has won numerous awards for his financial reporting. Now we've got just a couple of minutes left. Here's a brief piece from the AARP news section. Retirees seek to stay put. 3 in 4 want to retire in place. While it's common to daydream of someday moving to a sunny clime or exotic locale, a clear majority of American adults would prefer to stay in their current homes as long as possible, a new AARP survey of adults age 50-plus reveals. But only 46% think that will be possible. More than 3 in 4 people, 77%, agree with the statement, "I'd really like to remain in my community for as long as possible," according to AARP's Home and Community Preferences Survey, conducted by NORC at the University of Chicago. Nearly the same number hope to stay in their current house. But only about half of adults 50-plus think they'll be able to stay put. "We know that most people want to stay in their own homes, and the fact that many won't be able to says that we need to do more to ensure that people age the way they want to," says Joanne Binette, senior research advisor for AARP Policy Research and International Affairs. Among the poll's other findings, 36% plan to modify their homes to enable them to stay as they age. Bathrooms and entryways are the most likely modifications. People were split on whether they'd share their home in order to stay there. 32% said yes, and 29% said no. The full study can be found at aarp.org/livablesurvey2018. And one more little tidbit from the in the news of the bulletin. Feeling good about yourself? That's no surprise. A recent study published in the Psychological Bulletin found that self-esteem peaked at age 60 and remained constant until age 70. Among the nearly 165,000 people for whom data was available. For most, self-esteem declined only slightly into the 90s. Well, that's good news to look forward to. And now it looks as if we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. I hope that you'll listen next time, and I hope you've enjoyed today. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and today's programming is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us. So long till next time.